Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's also useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. At the onset, I start with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this series of programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles published on the topic of debt. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. Also, as the series of shows are interrelated, and one does build on the other in some fundamental ways, it's useful to check out the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt, and specifically Web is related to this series, Life and Debt Web. What we have been investigating in the most recent series is The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown, and have been using it as a textbook to understand some very basic and shocking truths about our money system and how we can break free from the problems. I up front always start with a basic premise. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. And this is something that most people do not know. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their money supply, inflating prices and robbing you of the value of your money. This turns out to be the fundamental problem in our whole financial system. The Web of Debt unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln, to name a few. So if you care about financial security, your own or the nation's, then you should deeply investigate the book, The Web of Debt, listen to these shows, and go back into the archives for some highly enlightening points about where we are in comparison to where most people think we are in terms of the financial system's structure. Let's begin where we left off last week with a small review. We were looking at England and money as a simple tally of accounts. England, over a millennia ago, was faced with the problem of what to use for money when the country was short of gold. The coinage type system was commodity based. It assumed that money was something having value in itself, gold or silver, which was bartered or traded for goods or services of equal value. So that was the assumption, and it's actually a better situation than we have today. However, it was not perfect. In any event, according to Stephen Zerlenga, who has traced the origins and history of money in his revealing compendium, The Lost Science of Money, the use of coins as money did not originate with merchants trading in the marketplace. The first known coins were issued by governments. and their value was the value stamped on them, not the price at which the metal traded. Zarlenga quoted Aristotle, who said, "Money exists not by nature, but by law. It acts as a measure that makes goods commensurate and equates them. There must then be a unit, and that fixed by agreement." In other words, money was a mere fiat of the law. Fiat's a Latin term. It means let it be done. Fiat money is money that is legal tender by government decree. It is simply a tally, something representing units of value that can be traded in the marketplace, a receipt for goods or services that can legally be tendered for other goods or services. In Mandarin China, where paper money was invented in the 9th century, this sort of fiat currency funded a long and prosperous empire. It's very important to remember that point of money being a tally, something representing units of value that can be traded in the market, a receipt for goods or services that can legally be tendered for other goods or services. The critical focus is the goods or services, not the money. Fiat money was used successfully in medieval England, but in England, it was made of wood. So this kind of tally system existed in China way back in the 9th century and also in England from 1100 AD. It started with King Henry I, who was son of William the Conqueror, who took the throne in 1100 AD. The printing press had not yet been invented, and taxes were paid directly with goods produced by the land. Under King Henry's innovative system, payment was recorded with a piece of wood that had been notched and split in half. One half was kept by the government and the other by the recipient. To confirm payment, the two halves were matched to make sure they tallied. Since no stick splits in an even manner, and since the notches tallying the sums were cut right through both pieces of wood, the method was virtually foolproof against forgery or counterfeiting, which, as you remember, were problems that undermined the continental script that the revolutionary originating American government tried to use. The tally system has been called the earliest form of bookkeeping. According to historian M.T. Clancy, in From Memory to Written Records, England, 1066 to 1307, he said tallies were a sophisticated and practical record of numbers. They were more convenient to keep and store than parchments, less complex to make, and no easier to forge. Only a few tallies have survived, but millions were made, according to Clancy. Tallies were used by the government not only as receipts for the payment of taxes, but to pay soldiers for their service, farmers for their wheat, and laborers for their labor. At tax time, the treasurer accepted the tallies in payment of taxes. By the 13th century, the financial market for tallies was sufficiently sophisticated that they could be bought, sold, or discounted. Tallies were used by individuals and institutions to register debts, record fines, collect rents, and enter payments for services rendered. In the 1500s, King Henry VIII gave them the force of a national currency when he ordered that tallies must be used to evidence the payment of taxes. That meant everyone had to have them. In the book War Cycles, Peace Cycles, Richard Hoskins writes that by the end of the 17th century, about 14 million pounds worth of tally money was in circulation. In comparison, Zarlenga cites a historian named Spufford, who said that English coinage had never exceeded 500,000 pounds up to that time. The tally system was thus not a minor monetary experiment, as some commentators have suggested. During most of the Middle Ages, tallies may have made up the bulk of the English money supply. The tally system was in use for more than 5 centuries before the usury bankers' gold-based paper banknotes took root. In other words, the tally system helped fund a long era of leisure and abundance prior to the gold-based paper banknotes. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. One of the big challenges in all areas of history is the revisionist changes that take place, and which we learn in the classroom. As is quite obvious, it is always those who conquer and control who write the history. For example, modern school books generally portray the Middle Ages as a time of poverty, backwardness, and economic slavery from which the people were freed only by the Industrial Revolution. But, in fact, reliable early historians painted a quite different picture. There were, of course, the Black Death and other scourges to contend with, but the economy itself evidently provided quite easy living conditions. Thorold Rogers, a 19th century Oxford historian, wrote that in the Middle Ages, a laborer could provide all the necessities for his family for a year by working 14 weeks. 14 weeks is only a quarter of the year. The rest of the time, some men worked for themselves, some studied, some fished. Some helped to build the cathedrals that appeared all over Germany, France, and England during that period. Massive works of art that were built mainly with volunteer labor. Some used their leisure to visit these shrines. 100,000 pilgrims had the wealth and leisure to visit Canterbury and other shrines yearly. William Cobbett, author of the definitive History of the Reformation, wrote that Winchester Cathedral was made when there were no poor rates, when every laboring man in England was clothed in good woolen cloth, and when all had plenty of meat and bread. Money was available for inventions and art, supporting the Michelangelos, Rembrandts, Shakespeares, and Newtons of the period. The Renaissance is usually thought of as the flowering of the age, but the university system, representative government in a parliament, the English common law system, and the foundations of a great literacy and spiritual movement were all in place by the 13th century, and education was advanced and widespread. As one scholar of the era observes, quote, "We are very prone to consider that it is only in our time that anything like popular education has come into existence. As a matter of fact, however, the education afforded to the people in the little towns of the Middle Ages represents an ideal of educational uplift for the masses, such as has never been even distantly approached in succeeding centuries. The 13th century developed the greatest set of technical schools that the world has ever known. These medieval towns, during the course of the building of their cathedrals, of their public buildings, and various magnificent edifices of royalty, and for the nobility, succeeded in accomplishing such artistic results that the world has ever since held them in admiration." End of quote. The common people had leisure, education, art, and economic security. According to the Catholic Encyclopedia, economic historians like Rogers and Gibbons declare that during the best period of the Middle Ages, say from the 13th to the 15th century, inclusive, there was no such grinding and hopeless poverty, no such chronic semi-starvation in any class as exists today among large classes in the great cities. In the Middle Ages, there was no resembling our proletariat, which has no security, no definite place, no certain claim upon any organization or institution in the socioeconomic organism. Now, Richard Hoskins attributes this long period of prosperity to what? The absence of usurious lending practices. Rather than having to borrow the moneylender's gold, the people relied largely on interest-free tallies. Unlike gold, wooden tallies could not become scarce, and unlike paper money, they could not be counterfeited or multiplied by sleight of hand. They were simply a unit of measure, a tally of goods and services exchanged. This needs to be once again underscored. The purpose of the money was to be a unit of measure of goods and services exchanged. As a result, the tally system avoided both the depressions resulting from a scarcity of gold and the inflations resulting from printing paper money out of all proportion to the goods and services available for sale, like has happened today. Since the tallies came into existence along with the goods and services, supply and demand increased together and prices remained stable. The tally system provided an organic form of money that expanded naturally as trade expanded and contracted naturally as taxes were paid. Bankers did not have to meet behind closed doors to set interest rates and manipulate markets to keep the money supply in balance. Tallies balanced the way a checkbook balances as a matter of simple math. The system of government-issued tallies kept the British economy stable and thriving until the mid-17th century, when Oliver Cromwell needed money to fund a revolt against the Stuart monarchy. Well, this leads to the next chapter, Pulling the Strings of the King, the Moneylenders Take England. If you remember from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz and the chapter on the Guardian of the Gates, when asked about the wizard, Oz is a great wizard and can take any form he wishes, but who the real Oz is when he is in his own form, no living person can tell. For those of you who are new to the series of shows, we are paralleling the Wonderful Wizard of Oz story with the true nature of contemporary economic structure, processes, and effects. It's an allegory showing the problems and how to get out of it to a degree. It is true that the image of a puppet and a puppeteer has long been a popular metaphor for describing the money power pulling the strings of the government. We see it in the newspapers every single day. Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister from 1868 to 1880, said, quote, "The world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes." This is, again, a very critical point in understanding how our global financial system is really run and impacting on us as prime mover of every level of our social and personal lives. Nathan Rothschild, who controlled the Bank of England after 1820, is quoted as declaring, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England to rule the empire on which the sun never sets. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply." This is precisely the thinking that has garroted essentially the world, the United States, and us individually today. Patrick Carmack, who is co-author of the documentary video The Money Masters, uses the puppet metaphor to describe the transfer of power from the royal line of English Stuarts to the German royal house of Hanover in the 18th century. What he said was, England was to trade masters. An unpopular King James II, for a hidden cabal of money changers pulling the strings of their usurper, King William III, from behind the scenes. This symbiotic relationship between the money changers and the higher British aristocracy continues to this day. The monarch has no real power, but serves as a useful shield for the money changers who rule the city. In its 20 June 1934 issue, New Britain Magazine of London cited a devastating assertion by former British Prime Minister David Lloyd George that Britain is the slave of an international financial bloc. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we get to the real crux of the matter. Where did these international financiers come from, and how had they achieved their enormous power? As you remember, the moneylenders had been evicted not only from England, but from other European countries. They had regrouped in Holland, where they plotted their return, but the English kings and queens staunchly resisted their advances. the king did not need to borrow money when he had the sovereign right to issue it himself. For a brief period in the 1500s, King Henry VIII relaxed the law concerning usury when he broke away from the Catholic Church, but when Queen Mary took the throne, she tightened the laws again. The result of this was to seriously contract the money supply, but Queen Elizabeth I, Mary's half-sister, was determined to avoid the usury trap. She solved the problem by supplementing the money supply with metal coins issued by the public treasury. The coins were made of metal, but their value came from the stamp of the sovereign on them. This was established as a matter of legal precedent in 1600, when Queen Elizabeth issued relatively worthless base metal coins as legal tender in Ireland. All other coins were annulled and had to be returned to the mints. When the action was challenged in the highest court of the land, the court ruled that it was the sovereign's sole prerogative to create the money of the realm. What the sovereign declared to be money was money, and it was treason for anyone else to create it. Zarlenga states that this decision was so detested by the merchant classes, the goldsmiths and later the British East India Company, that they worked incessantly to destroy it. According to Alexander Del Mar, writing in 1895, quote, "This was done by undermining the crown and then passing the Free Coinage Act of 1666, opening the way for the foreign element to establish a new monarch and to reconstitute the money prerogative in the hands of a specific group of financiers, not elected, not representing society, and in large part not even English." Well, Britain thrived with government-issued currency, tallies and coins, until the king's sovereign authority was eroded by Cromwell's revolt in the mid-17th century. The middle classes, the traders, manufacturers, and small farmers, sided with Parliament under Cromwell, who was a Puritan Protestant. The nobles and gentry sided with the king, Charles I, son of James I, who followed the Church of England, the Anglican Church, founded by Henry VIII. Although Henry had broken away from the Catholic Church, he advocated Catholic doctrine throughout his life and vigorously opposed the Protestants, who were more lenient than the Catholics towards usury and toward the Dutch moneylenders who practiced it. The moneylenders agreed to provide the funds to back Parliament on condition that they would be allowed back into England and that the loans be guaranteed. That meant the permanent removal of King Charles, who would have repudiated the loans had he gotten back into power. Charles' recapture, trial, and execution were duly arranged and carried out to secure the loans. Well, that leads to basically a Dutch-bred king who charters the Bank of England on behalf of foreign moneylenders. The man who would become King William III began his career as a Dutch aristocrat. He was elevated to Captain General of the Dutch forces and then to Prince William of Orange with the backing of Dutch moneylenders. His marriage was arranged to Princess Mary of York, eldest daughter of the English Duke of York, who reigned as James II of England from 1685 to 1688. James was then deposed, and William and Mary became joint rulers in 1689. William was soon at war with Louis XIV of France. To finance the war, he borrowed £1.2 million in gold from a group of moneylenders whose names were to be kept secret. The money was raised by a novel device that is still used by governments today. The lenders would issue a permanent loan on which interest would be paid, but the principal portion of the loan would not be repaid. The loan also came with other strings attached. They included, one, that the lenders were to be granted a charter to establish a Bank of England, which would issue banknotes that would circulate as the national paper currency. Two, the bank would create banknotes out of nothing, with only a fraction of them backed by coin. Banknotes created and lent to the government would be backed mainly by government IOUs, which would serve as the reserves for creating additional loans to private parties. Thirdly, interest of 8% would be paid by the government on its loans, making the birth of the national debt. And lastly, the lenders would be allowed to secure payment on the national debt by direct taxation of the people. Taxes were immediately imposed on the whole range of goods to pay the interest owed to the bank. The Bank of England has been called the mother of central banks. It was chartered in 1694 to William Paterson, a Scotchman, who had previously lived in Amsterdam. A circular distributed to attract subscribers to the bank's initial stock offering said, "The bank hath benefit of interest on all monies which it, the bank, created out of nothing." The negotiation of additional loans caused England's national debt to go from £1.2 million in 1694 to £16 million in 1698. By 1815, the debt was up to £885 million, largely due to the compounding of interest. The lenders not only reaped huge profits, but the indebtedness gave them substantial political leverage. What we see here is that the bank's charter actually gave the force of law to the fractional reserve banking scheme that put control of the country's money in a privately owned company. The Bank of England had the legal right to create paper money out of nothing and lend it to the government at interest. It did this by trading its own paper notes for paper bonds, representing the government's promise to pay principal and interest back to the bank, the same device used by the U.S. Federal Reserve and other central banks today. The next thing that happens is that the tally system of England went the way of the witches. After the Bank of England began issuing paper banknotes in the 1690s, the government itself followed suit by issuing paper tallies against future tax revenues. Paper was easily negotiable, making the paper tallies competitive with private banknote money. For the next century, banknotes and tallies circulated interchangeably, but they were not mutually compatible means of exchange. The banker's paper money expanded when credit expanded and contracted when loans were canceled or called, producing cycles of tight money and depression, alternating with easy money and inflation. The death knell was, however, that these notes appeared to be more sound than the government's tallies because they were backed by gold. They appeared to be sound until a bank's customers got suspicious and demanded all their gold at the same time, when there would be a run on the bank, like Mary Poppins, if you remember, and it would have to close its doors because it did not have enough gold to go around. Meanwhile, the government tallies were permanent money that remained stable and fixed. They made the banker's paper money look bad, and they had to go. The tallies had to go for another reason, too. King William's right to the throne was disputed, and the Dutch moneylenders who backed him could be evicted if the Catholics got back in and forbade moneylending again. To make sure that did not happen, the moneylenders used their new influence to discount the tallies as money and get their own banknotes legalized as the money of the realm. The tallies were called unfunded debt, while the Bank of England's paper notes were euphemistically labeled funded debt. Modern economic historians call this shift a financial revolution. And we will continue with this investigation next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.